to continue with 62, the solution was not entirely satisfactory, but it was a good working solution, and we got along very well with it after we rid ourselves of the outside pressures. I know up in Judge Patterson's office, they took quite a strong position in all this matter because the judge had been part of the Plattsburgh camp, and those fellows were moving in on it. But I managed to handle the thing. I might tell one amusing incident. I don't know whether this should ever be written up or not. But there came down from Judge Patterson's office, which was for supplies. He was the undersecretary and hadn't anything to do with the tactics and order. But he came down as sort of a representative of the Air Corps. And in this, he changed the general organization of the Air Corps in the War Department, and very notably its organization under me. And he showed it to Judge Mr. Stimson, and Mr. Stimson signed it. And it came into me. Well, that virtually deposed me as any controlling point here. But the main point was I wasn't even consulted. I wasn't even notified. But an officer that didn't pertain to this thing took charge of it and did this thing, and then it was sent to me, signed by the Secretary of War. Well, I handled that the way I did a good many things. Instead of getting mad, I just filed it in my desk and didn't turn it out at all. And, I suppose almost a year afterwards, certainly 6 months afterwards, when Mr. Simpson and I were having quite a battle over something we didn't agree about, Mr. Simpson said to me, he said, "Now, I'd like you to stop and think that we've gone along with you on everything you've put up. I don't think you can find anything that you haven't had my cordial support. I'm sure you know." I didn't say anything. And then he said, "Is there anything that hasn't had my cordial support of you as chief of staff?" Well, I reached into my desk and got this document, which he'd signed, which in effect gave it effect. It was signed by the Secretary of War. It was proposed by the undersecretary, who had nothing to do with that part of the Army. And Mr. Roosevelt, by an executive order, had put me in charge of operations over and above the Secretary of War and organization. And I said, "Well, Mr. Secretary, here's a pretty good answer, and this is about 6 months old. Maybe it is longer than that." And I gave him this, and he read it, and he came down to his signature. "Well," he said, "what's this?" Well, I said, "You signed it there. You ought to know." "Well," he said, "what's it doing there?" I said, "I filed it in my desk here." He said, "You filed it?" Well, I said, "You didn't consult me about it. That deposed me. And you were just talking about how you supported me in all these things. It had anything to do with Judge Patterson's responsibility. And yet he takes the initiative, and he writes the thing, and you sign it, and I'm out, and I'm not even spoken to." So I just put it in my drawer. That's a good place to solve these difficult questions. And Mr. Simpson said, "Well, I never saw anything like that." I said, "Well, I never heard anything like that either. But it didn't go any further than my drawer." Well, he said, "Well, just give it to me." Well, I said, "Hold on here. I've got an executive order from the president that I have a question of organization in my sole control. Now, are you going to take this out and start it all over again?" He said, "No, I'm going to give it to Judge Patterson, tell him to tear it up." But that shows the lengths to which they got in this matter. I think I answered 63, in which I said I didn't think it was possible to have a separate Air Corps during the war, and General Arnold was in complete agreement with me on this question. I'm going to turn that off. I don't recall any shortages that had, except in patrol aircraft and some fighter aircraft, that would have changed the situation at Pearl Harbor. We didn't have enough bombers to use as reconnaissance vessels to carry the reconnaissance around the complete circle and far out to sea. '66, please discuss the arrangement by which the surplus arms were transferred to the British after Dunkirk. At this time, by a recent law of Congress, anything that was of the military character that was to be given to Great Britain had to have the approval of the Chief of Staff. I think I've referred to this before. I think the law was unconstitutional. I think the Commander-in-Chief was the one, and they might forbid him. But I was under the Commander-in-Chief. Nevertheless, it was put up to me. Now, at this time, the problem was, how essential was a partial rearmament of the British from our then available old war stocks to the defense of the United States. I took the position that any measure then to prevent the complete collapse of Great Britain was of importance to the United States, because it would put the war on a different front and very threatening to us, and would permit its easy transfer to this side of the ocean and threaten the Panama Canal. Under that term, and so explained, I arranged for, I think, about 1 million rifles, and I've forgotten how many automatic rifles and machine guns of the First World War stock, and I think 500 75 millimeter guns to be transferred to the British. The tragedy of the matter was that when they issued these rifles, they could only give them 10 rounds of ammunition. And they went to the people of Great Britain to defend their towns and all when a German invasion was very much threatened and was presumed to be inevitable. But we hadn't any ammunition in excess of that to give them. So we did give them 10 rounds per gun. So they couldn't train for it, but they at least would have a rifle, and they at least would have 10 shots, because they were stripped to nothing at this time, and the only hope was that the civilians could arm themselves for a partial defense. This distribution of World War weapons didn't hurt our training program, because there were enough left of the World War weapons for such training as we might want to use them for. And we were beginning to get deliveries on the modern weapons. Turns on. In regard to Lend-Lease, I think that the passage of the Lend-Lease Act plainly declared our intimate relationship with Great Britain, our friendship with them. It didn't necessarily declare that, indicate that we were going to war with them, but it made it a probability better than a possibility. 68. I don't know what the result had been if we had not had Lend-Lease as to the British and Russians surviving. I think it would have been exceedingly difficult for Great Britain. Maybe not quite so difficult for Russia, though they were seriously lacking in many, many things. The Lend-Lease, 69, the Lend-Lease plan at first presented difficulties rather in a slowdown in the armament of our newly organized troops, but one which we felt at the time was plainly justified. 70. As far as I know, the Lend-Lease program was fairly well handled. Everybody could give you a different reason on how the things should be managed, but I think they did it pretty well. 71, I have no suggestions in regard to changes. Turn it off. I don't remember just what the reaction was in these hearings in relation to giving items to Russia. Hopkins' job with the president was to represent the Russian interests. My job was to represent the American interests. And I was opposed to any undue, what I call undue generosity, which might endanger our security. I thought that we gave too much at times, and Hopkins thought we gave too little, which would always be the case. 73, I've answered that question right now, just now. 74. I thought the administration dealt very generously with the Russian complaints. The Russians demanded everything, criticized everything. The point was they were fighting, and they're fighting hard. And we needed their fighting to keep the enemy engaged as much as possible. But their complaints were continuous and always have been. No matter how much you gave them, they didn't hesitate at all to complain bitterly about the whole thing. 5. I had gathered no idea how the Chicago Tribune and the Washington paper, Times Herald, gained access to the information that they publicized. 76. I do not know of any regret that the newspapers expressed privately. It didn't come to my attention if they did. 77. I do not know how to answer this question. It's extremely difficult to go ahead with war plans under the conditions that then existed. And yet we're fighting to prevent that sort of thing that is going on in Germany at that time, that was going on in Germany at that time. Surprise is one of the greatest factors of success in war. And we were being deprived of surprise all the way through. When you get before a military committee of Congress, some representative there, hostile to the administration, would ask you questions which would be fatal to answer. More particularly, if you refuse to answer, you almost answer the question. So it is a very difficult matter there to meet this these questions at that time under the circumstances. All one could do was the best they could. General. A general comment. the machine isn't working very well, and it's very hard to make my statements audible. I'm only doing it now by holding the receiver close to my mouth. We don't know what the trouble is, and we'll try to find it.
Would you ask him please to send down some cleaning fluid to clean this?
The sergeant wants you to send some of the special cleaning fluid that is needed to clean this machine, which undoubtedly they have in the Defense Department. But we've had a very hard time making a record that you can hear. It's occurred so suddenly, though, that I rather think some little thing has gotten out of gear.
From this question on, from question 54 on, is where it started.
The difficulty began with question 54. What's the next thing?
Well, that's from then on down.
You'll have to do the best you can with it.